Dig Deep is our monthly dive into big subjects. We bring together our commentators, Aaron Brown, he's the liberal, Chuck Maroney, he's the conservative. This month I asked them to dig deep into the state of journalism. It's easy to think that times we are living in are extraordinary, especially when it comes to journalism. Lack of local papers, fake news, biased reporting, social media, new ways to consume media. It's a difficult landscape to make sense of. I'm Heidi Holton, and joining me now is our liberal commentator, Aaron Brown, a Minnesota Brown conservative commentator and CEO and founder of Strong Towns, Chuck Marone. This is Dig Deep. Welcome, you guys.
Hi,
hey,
good to be here.
Thanks for having us. Fake news, that sounds like a great introduction.
Yeah, here we are, two purveyors of the evil product. Yeah.
Well, before we get into the present, I do think it's really easy to think that, like, back in the day, everything was so perfect and all the news you could trust. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the history and how things were as immigrants were coming into Minnesota. And
yeah, well, you go to the earliest days of media just here in northern Minnesota, and you're talking mostly about newspapers. One of the remarkable things that I think is kind of lost, and it is actually physically lost to time, is the fact that this northern Minnesota being an immigrant area, a newspaper was a voice, right? It was a voice for a particular audience. It played to an audience. And because of the number of immigrants, the number of languages spoken, you know, a range town like Hibbing would have 12 or at least 12 newspapers. And there were Swedish language newspapers, Norwegian newspapers, German newspapers, and not only that, Finnish newspapers, of course. And not only were there often newspapers in a particular language, but there might be two or three, depending on the politics and the inclinations of the people who speak that language. So, you know, you had this very diverse, well, it was as diverse as its audience. And then, of course, you had your, I guess what you'd call mainstream major newspapers, the larger newspapers, which would usually be the voice of the most powerful forces within the community. And certainly in a lot of the early days, that was the voice of, on the Iron Range, it was the voice of the mines. It was the voice of the mining advocates. Then you saw the rise of Labor World, which still publishes, has a rich history of publishing the labor movement's perspective in northern Minnesota. The media was really an expression of a point of view from these people who were living in this really interesting time. These communities were growing and literally being born and growing right in front of everybody. And the newspaper was how information was really the only way the information could be spread to all these people. And newspapers would travel down with the miners to be read. It would be in the family home. It would be at the bars and at the restaurants and in the boarding houses. And it was how people found out about what was going on. And it wasn't just one newspaper. It was many. And I think what then changed as people, as they became Americanized, I guess you'd say, they learned English and they settled into the country and their children became truly Americans, not just whatever immigrant identity they had before, you saw the need for that consolidate. You didn't need the foreign language newspapers like you did, but you still had the political and perspective divides. And so we still had multiple newspapers through the second generation of Iron Range immigration. And I say Iron Range because that's where I have been doing my research. And, you know, other parts of northern Minnesota and around the state might not have worked with quite so many different languages and peoples, but there certainly was a history of multiple newspapers. And the idea that there was one fair, unbiased, central newspaper is indeed not true. You wonder why some newspapers today have names like Democrat or Republican in their title, in the name of the newspaper. This was more common. There used to be newspapers called The Whig. Same deal, because they were literally identifying their partisan flag in the newspaper. And so these newspapers of the 1800s and early 1900s were exceptionally partisan. They viewed their role as to be partisan. I'm researching Victor Power, the mayor of Hibbing, and a Chicago newspaper came up to do a, it was a Democratic Chicago newspaper came up to do a story on Victor Power, I think thinking that because of his profile as an Irish American progressive that he would be a Democrat, and they came up and realized that he was actually a Republican, and they wrote, "A fine physical specimen of a man. Unfortunately, we found him a Republican," which I thought was a great line from that profile story. So, I mean, the idea that we come from, that somehow the media has been distorted by partisanship or by people who have strong beliefs dictating the debate in the media is not by any means new. It has merely changed, I think, in its technology and the rapidity of our news cycles, how fast it moves has changed. But we've always had to contend with the idea that understanding what was happening in our communities was something that was fraught with bias.
Well, one of the, I think, things that is hard for us to grasp today, because we're so outraged now by the partisan nature of what news has become. And we look back at this, what I think we think of as this nostalgic glory days of Walter Cronkite and mm-hmm. the Voice of the Nation.
Yeah.
Back in the days of early newspapers here in this region, and certainly in this country, and I think going back as far as they had before this golden age that we nostalgize, newspapers were not only partisan. The term yellow journalism comes from this. The muckrakers. I mean, the whole idea was that you were not pretending to be nonpartisan. You were out front with it. There was no separation between the people selling ads and the people writing print. There was no, like, you know, journalistic integrity. The whole idea was that you were out there trying to make a case and make your point. There was no independent reporting of news in the sense that you would pick up a paper and think that this was the unbiased, unblemished truth. I was even thinking today on the way over here, you know, the Federalist Papers, which we refer to all the time, even in, you know, Supreme Court cases, refers to the Federalist Papers, written by Alexander Hamilton, Madison, and John Jay. These were written anonymously. They were written as the name was Publius, was mm-hmm. who was the author of those. And there were anti-Federalist Papers that were also written anonymously. Not only did our journalism of that era just be patently biased, to get a point, but often the authors weren't even identified themselves. Thomas Jefferson wrote many, many things that was never attributed to Thomas Jefferson because he wanted to get a point out, but mm-hmm. also had to stay kind of above the fray. Now, take that to a small town. Take that to a local community where, like Aaron said, there's a Finnish paper and a Swedish paper. And you basically had, like, your own local rumor mill going that would kind of feed on itself in ways that I think today would make us all kind of cringe, in ways that do make us cringe today because it's very analogous to what you see on our social media. I think a lot of the hesitation that people have today with the way we consume news, historically looking back at the 50s and 60s and not looking back at what actually mm-hmm. was when journalism was more of a kind of Wild West endeavor.
Wild West is a good point because I always think of the Western towns. There's a movie, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, and I always think of Peabody, the newspaper publisher in that movie. Just one man with a, with a serious drinking problem and a printing press trying to do his version of what's right for his young state. What I think is a lot different is the access, literally getting the printing press was what you needed to do to have a newspaper, and the rest was basically if you could sell an ad, that was all cash in your pocket. And then if you got readers to buy your product and sell a few ads, well, then you had a business model. And it was easier to publish newspapers. And if you had an audience, you were celebrated, and as a newspaper, you were viable. That there was a marketplace of ideas there, where there were so many people who could start newspapers that the best ones, or the ones that were most popular or had the best dirt in it or that had the most unique voice. I'm looking at a lot of old newspapers now, and you really start to notice when a good publisher slash editor is in charge of a newspaper. And yes, they are biased and they have a perspective, but like I'm just thinking of Claude Atkinson and Hibbing with the Mesaba Orr, which was a paper that would become the Hibbing Tribune, merge with the Hibbing Tribune later. He went by Dad. He signed his editorials Dad, and which is kind of weird in our modern light. But he was pro-Victor Power, and he was a Republican and more of a progressive Republican, and all of those biases were in everything he wrote in the newspaper. So it wasn't like he was this perfect kind of Aristotle idea of a perfect journalist, but he was very thoughtful and expressed how his views changed based on information he was finding. He was very open about that in his editorials. We are learning this and we see it this way, and we are learning that. And I think that trust, there was a trust that was built in that process that made that newspaper, I think, looking back at it, fairly special for its time. And it wasn't the only newspaper, and there were a dozen other newspapers and lots of people who disagreed with this guy and his newspaper. But his paper, I think, gets quoted more often than most others in research of that time, because you could build a trust reading this guy that he was telling his understanding of the truth.
That's Aaron Brown. He's our liberal commentator on Northern Community Radio for Dig Deep. We're talking journalism today. Here's Chuck Marone. He's our conservative commentator.
We use the term, you know, yellow journalism, and we look at that as like bottom feeding somehow. Like but this is going to the worst of our human inclinations. But the reality is that it was a marketplace of ideas. You did have people of all stripes essentially able to get their thoughts out there. And yes, there were some voices on the margins. There were some crazy things that were written. There were some mainstream ideas that were also heretical. You saw the early, you know, the women's suffrage movement gain a lot of steam because they used their own publications to get their own story out, their own word out, their own take on events and ideas. You saw this around, if you go way back, not in this part of the country, but you go way back, you see this in the abolitionist conversation. You see this here in terms of Native Americans and our relations with them. You see this in the union formation.
Labor was big that way.
Labor was really big.
Labor couldn't get even considered by the mainstream newspapers.
Right.
You know, they were all radical horde as far as the newspapers were concerned. And you really had to find the original source of the labor movement to hear what their perspective was at all.
So if you think of this like marketplace of ideas, essentially what you had were a bunch of real heretical things out there. You know, some mainstream things, some heretical things. But the idea was you had an opportunity to get your voice out. And a lot of these things were one page. I mean, you're not talking, we think of the newspaper today, we think of something that's delivered by a newspaper delivery service. It's multiple pages, you open it up, it's ads. This is not what we were talking about back then. We were talking about like one page. Mm-hmm. You know, it might have one or two things on it. It would be very, you know, very light from a content standpoint.
And how was it consumed? So did you read the paper that you believed in? Were people reading many papers? Do you know that kind of thing? Because that's what people are talking about a lot nowadays, is the consumption of what you already believe.
Mm-hmm. I think that you were inclined, much the same way we are today, your daily routine was going to include the stuff that was closest to your tribe, right? So you go to your bar, your establishment, your church, you're going to get those newsletters there. Would there ever be any crossover? Well, in the days when it was, you know, in Finnish or in Swedish, yeah. Less, as it all became in English and the conversation emerged, mm-hmm. What you saw were, as Aaron suggested, consolidation of different operations, ideas being brought in, ideas being like translated across different cultures, divides, so showing up in different publications. It's a lot of what we see today digitally that kind of makes us a little bit queasy. You saw this, the exact same thing in print, you know, 100 years ago in this area. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you can imagine the mining executive getting all ticked off because of these union rags out there getting, you know, spread around. And you can picture like the union organizer saying, yeah, you know, our official publication is this one and, you know, we're not have to deal with those over there, but yet winking and nodding at them like, you know, yeah, you're getting, you know, valuable stuff out. And you can picture the mining executive, you know, I'm going to support this newspaper. We're going to give money to them, get our message out. But then, you know, when the real ultra pro mining people came out with their kind of crazy stuff, you're like, yeah, you know, I might not be with him, but he makes a valid point. You know, it's the same like marketplace of ideas that we have today is what you were dealing with back in those days.
I think the supply and demand of those times is a big thing to consider, though, too, because humans are curious. They want information. You know, they want the gossip. They want the news. They want to know what might affect their lives. That's what makes humans humans, is that curiosity. And everybody who's ever formed a community has had this communal curiosity that newspapers or flyers or town criers or whatever, they've always had some means of expressing information across the community. What I think has changed between then and now is then there was only so much time in a day. You were talking about how the newspapers weren't that big, you know, and a lot of them were one page or a four page spread, and they were these big glorious giant pages of the time. And one of the things you have to think about is that these small newspapers who had maybe a handful of people working there would have to set the type.
Yeah,
you know, every letter. You talk about tweets, tweets being 140 characters. How about if you had to physically place the characters with your fingers or tweezers and then imprint, once you have a whole page of tweets, a whole day's worth of Twitter consumption laid out letter by letter on a printing press, then you have to print your paper, tear it all down and do it all again the next day. There's just not much time to put out all but what you really need. That's why AP style comes from the short abbreviated form of writing that journalists use, comes from the fact that you don't dare put somebody on the job of putting extra letters in a word or in a sentence. So there was a lot of demand for information, and getting it to people was a little harder. You know, it was a challenge. It wasn't and a physical like it was affordable. You could probably start your own newspaper a lot easier than you could today, but it was difficult work and you had to really be dedicated to get it across. Right now, the issue is people are still curious, but there is endless supply of information. Endless supply of information, and it is really difficult to, as a consumer, to understand what I need to consume, because everything I want is, if I want to look at something, I can take this phone that I'm using to time this conversation and I can turn it into a computer to look at Facebook or Twitter or the newspaper of my choice or the libraries of the universe. It's all there. And as a result, an individual newspaper publisher in a small town is not competing with other small town newspapers anymore. They're competing with the entire friggin' world. Mm-hmm. To get their information across.
And let me just make one kind of closing point to the look back. I think that nostalgic period of the 60s and the Walter Cronkite era.
Watergate.
Mm-hmm. It's an era that we look back at with nostalgia. I think if you talk to people mm-hmm. back then, they wouldn't have been so nostalgic about their own time. I mean, they would have said this is a traumatic time and da da da. But to me, that is the historical anomaly. Yeah. And it was really based off of a transition from print, which is a widely distributed media, to radio and then television, which was a very limited media that could be dominated by one or two people of huge integrity, right? A Walter Cronkite kind of person. Once that started to become a broader, you know, kaleidoscope of people, which really, by the time you get to the late 80s, that's what people wanted. I mean, you saw the reemergence of AM radio as kind of a counter to, hey, we can't get our message out on regular mainstream media. And that even carries mm-hmm. through. That mantra still carries through. People were hungry for alternative voices. And I think it's important for us to look at that as the crazy anomaly, mm-hmm. not today. Because today and before that period of time is really more akin to what really since Gutenberg we've all experienced.
And I think anytime you wheel out a new medium, and this could perhaps be a part of our future conversation here, is the distrust or learning of that new medium is a big part of it. Because the printing press came out, and for the longest time, you could print Bibles. It was hard to print anything but something that the central state or church supported.
Well, the most heretical thing that was done with the printing press right away was they translated the Bible to German. Mm-hmm. I mean, oh my gosh, now you can actually read the Word of God, and guess what? He doesn't say what you were telling me he says.
Yeah.
So this was like, you know, socially disruptive,
right,
at a degree we can't even fathom today.
But it was widely distrusted, though, and so by the authorities, by everybody, so there was an era of caution, and television was the same way. They wanted to make sure that this TV wasn't going to come into their home and rot their children's brains and destroy our understanding of what the real news was. So I think early pioneers were very careful, and that care and extra attention to things like trying to balance bias and trying to follow the truth and not our political inclinations, that kind of came out of that caution. And then when someone realized you could make a buck not being cautious... then it was all over.
Bets off.
Yeah.
In our next segment of Dig Deep, we'll take a look at, we'll come more into the future and consolidation, how things have changed in terms of media. That's Aaron Brown and Chuck Marone. You can hear the second in our State of Journalism conversation coming up this Wednesday morning at 8:10, or sign up for the Dig Deep podcast or catch up online, kexe.org.